encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Welcome in, listeners, to another episode of the Fergie Fledglings podcast. I'm your host, Colin Dams, joined by Nathan Heinchel and Polly Questel. We're going to talk about the Tottenham game, obviously, but first we're going to talk about the Mason Greenwood news as briefly as we can. So last week, there were a lot of reports that came out in The Athletic suggesting that Manchester United had already made a decision to bring him back. Adam Crafton reported that at the beginning of August, club officials were told by Richard Arnold that preparations were being made for Greenwood to return. I would say almost coinciding with that report, Manchester United released a statement that looked pretty hastily put together, saying that no decision had been made yet. And they were still, considering their options, and that, in the next few days they would announce their decision. Obviously, that set off a lot of backlash, I would say, social media. But I think the groundwork that's been done by supporters clubs, there was a United Fans Against the Return of Mason Greenwood group that became official and released a statement, along with all sorts of other reports suggesting that there were people within the club who didn't want him, and obviously the women's team that didn't want him back. Reports that players in the first team that did not want him back. There were reports that club employees were considering resigning if the return of Mason Greenwood happened. It was a very chaotic few days leading to this morning, Manchester United announcing that Mason Greenwood is not going to play for Manchester United. They were not very clear on what the plan is going forward, whether they're going to try and loan him out or sell him, whether he's just not going to return to the team at all. But what was clear from the report, from the statements from the club this morning, as well as a letter from Richard Arnold, is that they seem to be covering their tracks. A lot of suggestion in the language used to defend Mason Greenwood that they were definitely leaning towards him coming back, as was reported. A lot of credit obviously goes to Adam Crafton for the reporting that he did, and for the, Manchester United employees that were, maybe sources of information in those reports. It's very clear that a lot of people did not want him back that had the, some say in the matter. So there we are. Polly, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I think it was very clear from day one the club were figuring out a way to bring him back. If they weren't trying to figure out a way to bring him back, they would have gotten rid of him in February.
That's what I said.
Yeah, now they're like trying to weasel. There's a simple thing that they can do. They can buy him out of his contract. They can pay him and get him out. Which is what they're going to ultimately end up doing. If they find him another club, the wages are going to be drastically different. He's going to get paid everything that he's owed. It won't be reported on the way that they report on Harry Maguire wanting a buyout, but that's what's going to happen. They're not doing that because, again, it's money. It's a money thing. This speaks to how this all comes from the top and how you choose to run a ship. This all comes back to the Glazers and how they are choosing to run a ship. If the owner were to come out in February and just say, get rid of him, we don't want this guy representing our club anymore, I don't care what you have to do. If you have to launch an internal investigation to find a way to get rid of him, you do that and we'll get rid of him in 2 weeks. They would have done that. This was a team that was looking for a way to keep him around. They can't terminate his contract. So if they want to get rid of him, they have to give him what he's owed, which is why they're looking to sell him and everything, because they don't want to just pay him. It speaks to the financial and everything. And what's very obvious, and a lot of the reporting today essentially said that without saying it, but was very obvious that people high up in the club did not want him back, and they lost that fight. And they just turned and went straight to the media. And they went, well, we know that the court of public opinion will win here. And like I tweeted on Friday, it was like Crafton probably saw the emails and memos himself. There's, and it seems, and I would have said one person would have been giving that to him. But the reporting that came out today was basically everybody at the club probably had his email address just going straight to him. And they knew the way to wait, they lost this decision that they knew and felt was right. And they knew the way to combat that was just go straight to the media. And this is not, and that's a unique situation for this decision, because I guarantee you that these people are not, they do not win every argument that they're in. And when they lose, they don't go straight to the media. But in this case, they knew they were in the right. The club was doing disgusting wrong things, looking out for the bottom line rather than anything else. And again, they know that, and it all comes back from the fact that right from the jump, the club knew they could not terminate the contract. So they're just trying to not have to pay all that money out.
Yeah. It seemed pretty clear from the start of this, I guess since the charges were dropped, and they were not cleared, they were dropped, that Neil Custis from The Sun, I think, had an in with the Greenwood family, based on some of the reports that were coming out of him, the very positive Greenwood reports, including that Erik ten Hag was in favor of Mason Greenwood returning to the squad. But it wasn't the difference between those reports and other reports that came from The Sun that seemed to be false is that pretty much every media outlet, I think, suggested that Erik ten Hag was on board with this.
It's also The Sun. So you're going to be careful about what you believe from them anyway. Yeah. And if you had to guess, if you told me, oh, one outlet is going to be reporting that Greenwood should come back, I, without hesitation, would be like, obviously, that's The Sun.
Yeah. I think The Sun and the Daily Mail were both pretty regular with that. But the idea that basically all of the decision makers on the football side were on board with this from the start, I think we maybe could have just assumed from, you know, him not being released earlier, or maybe not released, but bought out, or the club making a very clear stance that he was not going to return. And this is, I mean, we have to acknowledge that this is a reoccurring problem with Manchester United, not just with the way that they, you know, postured themselves to boost Cristiano Ronaldo's character, as well as, you know, a player on the pitch when he returned. And there was a lot of talk when he returned about, you know, the case that at that time was ongoing, the civil case concerning the incident in Las Vegas where he was accused of rape. Ryan Giggs having club officials, you know, appear as character witnesses, including Sir Alex Ferguson in his case of domestic violence. And now, you know, reports emerging again about Antony accused of domestic violence by his former partner, which, you know, that's going to be something else the club is going to have to deal with. And I'm sure, you know, possibly in a sick way, is getting more media attention because of the Mason Greenwood situation. But, you know, these are things that the club can't run from as much as they try to. And they try to.
No, I will say, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this without basically saying stick to football. But It's a nasty area of the game. Like I'm like Manchester United should be ashamed of how they have handled this and everything. It's not exclusive to Manchester United. Arsenal keep trotting out a player who has been accused of rape. If someone at Arsenal was on trial, I would bet a lot of money that Arsene Wenger would be there as a character witness. And that goes, that's not a football thing. It's a sports, like it transcends football. It's in many sports. Like we see this in the NFL all the time, is players domestic violence and teams rightfully right away, they'll cut them, but then somebody else, well, you can sack the quarterback, so therefore you have value to me. and therefore I'm going to bring you in on my team. I don't care if you shot someone. You could catch passes. You could get by your cornerback and beat the safety in a jump ball. You can catch 30-yard passes. And so I think when we move past this, it's like, yeah, there's character issues on a lot of people. But when we talk about other things, it's like factoring in solely the football reasons on plenty of the other things, I think, that we have to say about Manchester United these days.
Nathan, how you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing okay. I will reflect a lot of the same things that have been said here. First thing that's really important to me is one, you know, hopefully acknowledging that the victim is finding some kind of solace. I'm sure this is only continuing to redig up old wounds for them, and it's incredibly unfair and probably very hurtful for them. I think it's interesting that kind of the side conversation since the news broke this morning, a lot of people have re-brought up the Super League specifically, and how that was something where United got shamed into backing out of a thing that they absolutely were planning on doing. They were the ones
behind it. They were pioneers of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, this organization is as quick as they are to make a decision that everyone like raises an eyebrow at, they're also pretty quick to kind of get knocked off of that decision. You know, if the perception is that bad, and I mean, it's amazing.
I wouldn't say that they're quick to make that decision. What's astonishing is that they keep making that decision. Like a year ago, This team was ready to sign Marco Arnautovic, and they were like, and the backlash was like, oh, we can't do that. So how did you expect Mason Greenwood to go down?
Yeah, and so all the reporting that's come out too, and you just got to keep giving a shout out to The Athletic and Adam for the reporting that was going through and kind of how the Talk of the Devils guys all were very, I think, succinct in their thoughts kind of post the first initial reporting coming out. And I think there was a lot of visible anti, like, what are we doing here? Like, why are we bringing this person back? Which helps. And then you see all this reporting about how, like, United was anticipating all these things and who might be a hostile actor towards,
they had a plan for like what pictures they would take of him in training.
It was everything about it's really gross. And I mean, I posted it in the Slack channel. I think, the way United approached this, specifically the key stakeholders that were making these decisions, like Richard Arnold, I think he needs to resign. I can't imagine, after the amount of pressure that came, that started internally, that then was able to make change externally, I don't know how those people are going. Like, if you're in the ownership and you're looking at it, like, I don't understand how our staff of over 1,000 full-time employees, I think is what Andy Mitten said, there's like over 1,000 full-time employees that work for United. How are they going to continue to want to work for Richard Arnold after the decisions that have been made? So I think there's a lot of there is clearly a need for a culture change that's happening inside of that building. And I mean, frankly, some of the reports that we're seeing, you know, there could be a culture change that needs to happen in the first team as well. That starts at the top of the first team, which would be, you know, Darren Fletcher, Eric Ten Hag. Like, I mean, everybody who is involved in this decision has got some real soul searching they need to do. They got dirt on their hands. There just needs to be culture changes, and it's probably going to have to come from an external source. I hope for, you know, United's sake, so that way they don't have to lean back on this, like, well, let's consider bringing this person back for business and financial reasons. I hope they're looking at the way they're making their contracts for the future. You know, you and I and most everybody can be fired for their positions because for the same reasons, right? You know, because you're potentially bringing a negative impact to the company that you work for. Like, is this not a thing that exists in Manchester United's contracts that could then get them to, you know, basically just end the deal right there?
It is.
Yeah. So it's just.
Yeah. There's like there's a code of conduct or something, you know, like there are things in place that they could have used to support, you know, the correct decision, which is to not let him back into the team and not let him play football again. And they deliberately chose to weasel their way out of it.
Better players have been gotten rid of for less. Yeah. And again, like, I'm not going to publicly talk about what the reason is behind them not wanting to terminate his contract, but it is more sinister than even what the discussion that we're having.
Yeah.
So, say at least, it's all been very disappointing. I think over the last couple of years, you know, we've had to have a moment at some point on this podcast where we put on our serious voices and we're talking about something that is very upsetting outside of what's happening between the lines, something that's incredibly frustrating that's happening outside of the lines. And it's just disappointing that it's a thing that keeps coming up. I think it really is causing, I think, a disconnect for people who want to support the team and support, you know, the players. I mean, shoot, I have a draft right now that's written like three quarters of the way written. How I want to talk about how important it was that, you know, we got to do the United preseason tour in New York, and like how it was just emblematic of how much Manchester United has meant in my life, and like how the connections that I've been able to build through it. And so, you know, the cool things that I've gotten to do since I started working for the Busby Babe and started following Manchester United and all these things. And like, it's an article I don't want to finish now for all the reasons, as you can imagine. It's like, why am I going to keep bending over backwards and talk about like how important this club is to me when the people who are making the decisions clearly are not operating in a way that's ethical or morally right. And it's so business focused that it's not focused on the community side of things. So,
you know, I was wondering why you said you almost had something finished like 2 weeks ago and I never saw it. So
yeah, it started off really, it's actually probably pretty decent, but I think it's going to sit in the can for a while. We might do a retrospective in a year.
Yeah.
And talk about how much fun that trip was, but
Yeah. I mean, just one more thing. I know we said we were going to keep this quick, and it has not been quick, but just one more thing that stuck out as like, I feel like we can't have this conversation without mentioning that, like, the club, very, you know, whether intentional or not, were clumsy enough that this invited abuse to their women's players on social media. And, you know, by default, that worked its way to the England camp, because Katie Zella, Mary Earps, and Ella Toon were part of England's run to the World Cup final, and, you know, were suddenly targeted on all of their social media posts about, you know, people asking for Mason Greenwood to come back, based on these fake, you know, at the time, you know, reports that the women's players were being consulted, only to come out later that they were in fact consulted. It was just that their opinion was not taken by the club. And then Richard Arnold has the audacity to say in his open letter that he took timing into account to avoid the very situation that happened based on the club's own unnecessary and, just irresponsible
letter itself was
gauging of interest. Yeah. Everything that was coming out just seems like it was this way to gauge interest in.
And it was like, this player's damaged goods, so we're getting rid of him, but also not so damaged goods that you shouldn't want to buy it.
Right. It's like the consequences of this are much more severe than I think they were, smart enough to think out at the time that they were planning all this out. It was just a shit show from the get go. All right.
So then they lost to Tottenham. And was that because they were bad at football, or was karma out to get them?
Why not both?
Yeah, I think you'd be a little bit of a both.
Yeah. 2-0 loss to Ange Postecoglou's reinvigorated Big Tottenham Ange. Hotspur. You know, props to Tottenham, because they were, I don't want to say the harder working side. That's going to sound like a very casual football commentator thing. But I mean,
the sprint numbers do back that up.
No, yes, they literally were the harder working side. But I mean, they just had a directness to their attack that always seemed dangerous, even when they didn't have the ball for, you know, long stretches. I'd say for the first like 25 minutes of the match, it looked like United were going to score at some point. And then it just, you know, all went to hell after that. Pauly, was this more of the same that we saw at Wolves, against Wolves?
In a way, it was more of the same. It was more of the same in that it looked once again just like last season. It looked like all the same problems that we had last season are back. It looked again like Manchester United, just very predictable. We keep talking, or people keep talking about United's press and how good United's press has been. And I got news for you. Like, look, they've won the ball high up the field more than any other club in the league after two games. That is good. They are turning those wins into shots about 20% of the time, which is better than what they were doing last year. They're not turning them into really good scoring chances, which is a problem. And the other problem is when it doesn't work, it's going the other way very quickly, very easily, at a very high rate. They haven't got so like in that regard, they haven't gotten any better at it, because they're not, you know, it's not generating a whole lot of an attack for them, and it's putting a lot of pressure on their defense, which Casemiro looking very, very old very quickly, and you're asking him to do a lot of things. But also, it's, they don't really tailor it to anything. It's the same thing. Like they press narrow, they leave a fullback open on the far side of the pitch, and Tottenham were ready for that. 30 seconds of the match, Tottenham broke a press very easily by just moving it to the far side and getting it to that free man right before the second goal. Same thing happened. They just moved it to the free man and he carried it up the field. When it doesn't work, it's bad, and you know, again, we watched the first half where it just looked like United were good, but not good enough. I'd say it was more they weren't bad, which is not good, rather than they were good. And then halftime comes, and how many times have we seen, especially in these games against their top six rivals, that they go into halftime and it looks like only one team makes adjustments, and then they blow the door off United in the second half?
I mean, I would say we're well past the point, given it happened pretty much every single time last season, of these sort of away fixtures have become a problem in Erik ten Hag's planning. It's a weakness in his game. How was that addressed?
Grace Robertson.
That's the thing, is like, it's a weakness in his game, and it doesn't seem like it's changing. Is it? There doesn't seem, when they lost 4-0 to Brentford, it was like, oh, okay. At the very least, we knew it's not working. Things need to change. And Ten Hag did that. And it wasn't just, okay, I dropped Harry Maguire and Cristiano Ronaldo. It was, he basically parked the bus to such a degree that Jose Mourinho would be proud, and said, we are going to play we're going to sit back, defend, counterattack. And that was the change. And then slowly throughout the season, he started getting them back to being more of a Ten Hag side. And now it's, and as the season progressed, other problems would come, and it just seemed like he was like, right, that's a problem, we'll play through it, rather than like play around it, make an adjustment. It seems like he is dead set on this. They look, I said this against Wolves, I was like, they just look very predictable. And against Tottenham, it was the same thing. And there doesn't seem to be any, when things aren't going right, there doesn't seem to be any sort of like, how do we fix this? Which, similar under Van Gaal, but at least Van Gaal would then just be like, all right, put on the Belgian lad and just hoof it to him. I'm like, there's none of, you know, and not saying that that was a good plan B and that Ten Hag should be doing that, but there doesn't seem to be anything. And at the end, you just get Bruno standing there and he goes, all right, I'm just going to shoot. And Casemiro, I'm just going to shoot. And everybody starts to play like individuals. And you think back to 2 years ago when they scored so many late goals and they scored so many late winners and were down at halftime. So, or were down in the second half so often. And that never happened. It was, they just kept playing their game. And then under Ralf Rangnick, it did happen. It was like when things went wrong, it became individuals. And what's happening now, because it seems like there is no plan, they win the ball high up the field. Great. And then whether it's Antony, whether it's Rashford, whether it's Garnacho, the decision-making just keeps killing them. And that's not going to change. We discussed that last week. Antony's been with Ten Hag for how many years? If he's still making bad decisions now, it ain't going to change. United had all the territory in this match, but they couldn't get the ball in the box. Where's the idea? The only people who do that still all these years later, it was a complaint under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. They didn't have the creativity to break down a low block. And it is still all these years later, the only two people who could pick out a pass are Luke Shaw and Bruno Fernandes. And Colin sent a text on Saturday that was just like, it looked again like great for high energy for the half hour and then dying or drop and then dropping off. The levels drop off after a half hour, 45 minutes. It's been a year. How is that still happening? It's not just, and there was every excuse last season. All right, new coach, new manager that we have to get used to. Then the games started piling up. There was a World Cup in the middle. United played from the World Cup until like April, basically every 3 days. I can understand why the players were tired. They were exhausted. They couldn't do it. It's game two. There was no international tournament this year. You had your first team squad with you the whole preseason. You had a whole preseason to work with them. So that's not an excuse anymore. You had 8 preseason games. The first team only played 3 of them. So it can't be that they played too many preseason games and that they're too tired. I'm sorry, they didn't only play 3. Your first team only started together in 3 of them. Some players like Mason Mount played a few more, etc. Either, you can't say that they played too many and that they wore them down before the season started. Did they not play enough that they can't go 90 minutes? 2 games into the season, that their fitness levels are not there yet. If that's the case, then you did a poor job managing your preseason and getting your team ready. Or can they just not go 90 minutes and this style of play? In which case, that's a problem that you're playing that you're putting a style of play on the field that your players cannot do.
It doesn't help either that, like, literally every turnover, they have to, track 6 runners going at them full speed, from one end of the pitch to the other. It seems like there's a lot of focus on like transition play at the beginning of the season, but it doesn't seem like they're like fishing for the opportunities to have that. There's been a couple where like Andre Onana has been used. There's been a couple like crossfield passes that have, kickstarted something through Garnacho, but like Antony is a drive killer, to use an American football term. When he gets the ball, charging forward, he'll stop once he gets to the final third and he'll just like toe tap it until he's like, oh, I actually have to make a decision. And by that point, the ball's either gone or he crosses it into the defender. Sometimes he'll shoot.
Right. I call him Carmelo Antony, because like you put him on a basketball team where they're running up and down the floor and then you get Carmelo who's like, wait for me. I'm going to get it. And I'm going to stop.
It's time to spot up and shoot.
Yeah. Or get it to the big guy in the low
except,
post. Like.
Except Antony isn't even a mid-range guy. He's like shooting from the arc.
Right. It's they've talked about transition because transition's now the keyword or the buzzword or the good word
instead of counterattack.
You don't want to say counterattack. Counterattack was bad because that was Solskjaer and that was bad. Is the media narrative and what the fans believe. United scored more goals from counterattacks last year than than all but one season in the Premier League, except I think it was 2009. With Rooney, Ronaldo, Tevez, Berbatov. They scored more. Otherwise, last year was the second most. And Ten Hag understood, all right, this team isn't good at bringing down a low block. So, like, what is their strength? Is getting in behind. So let's figure out a way to create those opportunities. And it was sort of like drag defenders out, drag people up the pitch. But you're seeing the way that United press, the way that they build up defenses, like Wolves did it, and Tottenham were pretty good at it too, of like just managing to use two players to take out three United players and to cut off the angles to three different players. And then you don't, and now you have an extra man, so you can leave your defenders back and make sure that Marcus Rashford doesn't have room behind. And United are, they're trying to create these transitions to catch defenses out, and they're doing it very high up the pitch. Because it's like, yeah, that's where our attackers are best. But are they? I don't think United's attackers are the best at, when they win the ball in the final third, at quickly transitioning to attack and getting a shot. They are at their best when they can run in behind. And that means maybe you need to win the ball back.
Win the ball
in the
back
middle
in midfield.
Third.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's what they did. Third more. That's what they did last year.
And now they're winning the ball back high up the pitch, but they can't convert it into chances, and
or the ball gets past them and they have to run all the way back down the pitch.
Right. Well, when the ball gets past them, and sometimes it's not even a pass that does it. Sometimes it's just someone lunges in for a challenge and misses. And when that happens, there's nothing. You're just giving them free run at you. Casemiro has been dribbled past more than any player in the league so far through two games, which speaks, leaves out how many challenges he's won. He's won a lot, but it speaks to how many he finds himself in. And if Casemiro doesn't win the challenge, you're in trouble. It's a system that is built heavily along the strength of that. And that's along the strength of Casemiro. And that's kind of a problem. What if he's not around? We, 2 weeks ago when we were doing the season preview, or whenever, we talked about the new rules and this and that, and worried about Casemiro getting suspended. Yellow cards, he got two red cards last year. I don't think we have to worry about that, because if Casemiro is going to get a yellow card, that means he has to catch up to them first. Although he did start the game by like just body checking James Maddison off of a throw-in, which should have been a booking. Was lucky to get away with that. It was just such an unnecessary hit. And again, it comes down to, is the coach putting the players in the best position to succeed? Like, I understand that's how you want to play. Your idea of how to play football and how to win is win the ball up high, create those quick transitions. But if Marcus Rashford and Alejandro Garnacho are not good at that, they're better when you win the ball around the halfway line and then play them in behind the forwards. Maybe that's something you want to consider doing. Mason Mount has never been a deep midfielder. And like, obviously, yeah, you need more support for Casemiro. Wolves exposed that badly. But like, you just signed Mason Mount, who's like kind of this defensive number 10 kind of guy. And you're going to play.
He runs a lot.
In the base of a midfield next to Casemiro. Like, that's not really putting him in a position to succeed. And if that's the case, like, if that's the position you're going to feel like, put him, you should have went out and signed a real midfielder and put him there. You did it with Christian Eriksen last year, too. Like, that's not his position.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then you wonder why we don't get control of a match. Why the midfield constantly gets... Why does every team that we play, whether it's two players or three players, they look like they have a world-class midfield against us week after week after week?
We're two games into the season, and we're already back on the please sign a midfielder shtick. Nathan.
We're never off of it.
Nathan.
Colin, what's up?
Do you think Erik ten Hag changes things up like he did two games in last season? Or do you think that Nottingham Forest is the kind of team where he's like, we'll give it one more shot?
I don't know. This team's not really scoring goals, and we're going up against Matt Turner in goal, which makes me nervous. Former Richmond kicker Matt Turner.
I hope that fence that you're sitting on is comfortable. It doesn't have spikes on the top.
I'm wearing a kicker sweatshirt right now.
I'm just saying that, like, you were asked a question and you could not have gotten on the fence quicker.
I mean, I think there's, I got to, I, for full disclosure to the listeners, I watched the first game. I missed the second game because I was working a kickers game, the former club of Matt Turner, who is currently the starting goalkeeper for Nottingham.
He's contractually obligated to mention former Richmond kicker, Matt Turner.
Yes.
Right.
That is,
also, the listeners actually, should be aware, if the game happened on a weekend, you probably didn't watch it.
Yeah. It, only for a couple more weeks, and then our season's done, and then I'm back to full time United.
Unless they start at 7:30.
Well, yeah, I mean that's a given. We don't.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Yeah. So the window of like 9 to 12:30 kicks, golden.
What do you do about the new like 3 o'clock kicks on Saturday?
Yo, that's gonna be a problem, man. Like
that's so brutal.
Me and my girlfriend gotta go like apple picking. You know, yeah. It's the fall.
This must be a comfy fence.
Yeah. But no, so I mean I think based off of the one game I watched and the highlights of the second game I watched, I mean there's got to be something of a change. Like I mean, especially since we already know that Antony is Antony. Like I don't know how you start him against Nottingham Forest. Like
well, that might be the team to start him against because he's gonna, you know, I mean he scored against them what, twice last year.
Yeah, I just there's a couple things that I'm just not seeing from the team right now, and it's frustrating. It seems like it's clearly going to be an issue if you put Casemiro on an island. This is something that we were worrying about last year, and maybe we didn't see it as much last year. We did see it towards the tail end of last year, and I think it's going to be a prevailing issue. Casey was tweeting about it a lot over the weekend. About how you've got to get Casemiro some help. And it feels like there's kind of a weird redundancy that's happening right now with having Bruno and Mason out on the pitch at the same time. While you have three attackers who all just want to dribble into the feet of opposing defenders. So it's like, whenever you get some kind of sustained possession, you're not doing anything with it up top. And so it's just putting additional pressure out on the defense. Then when the ball, you know, starts coming their way, you know, if you're asking me for a solution right now, I don't know if I necessarily have it. I think Jadon Sancho probably earned a start at this point. And I think it's probably a little telling that, you know, against Tottenham, they put two goalkeepers on the bench. Like, there's definitely still depth issues that need to be addressed. I hope we're still in maybe for Aaron Bott or they were talking about Gravenberch today, which maybe makes me a little nervous because he hasn't done a whole lot for Bayern, and he's another.
No, they're waiting. Like they're waiting on somebody to be sold.
Did you just butcher both of those names?
What's up?
Yeah, but you just butchered both of those names.
Oh, did I?
Amrabat and Gravenberch.
Oh my bad. Well, I mean, okay. The second one
you did better on. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was me growing up in the American South for 31 of my 32 years. I'm sorry. What makes me nervous about the way United are playing right now is it is all creating a bad vacuum for Rasmus Højlund for when he starts, because there's going to be so much pressure that is now
there's a lot of pressure on him because the rest of the team aren't performing.
Yeah,
and so then all of a sudden, like that's why, like I was really nervous. Like I'm excited about Rasmus Højlund. I think he'll probably be pretty good. But he's being set up right now to have a Darwin Nunez year.
A great tweet today that was it was like showing one of those, it was like Eric Cantona, one of those promotional videos of like Cantona on the feet, standing like center the middle of the field of like an empty Old Trafford, just like standing there taking it all in, and the caption was just Højlund waiting for the service, waiting for the crosses to come in when Rashford and Antony are on the wings.
Yeah, maybe we should go the
Colin. What did you think about going with an unchanged 11? How did you feel about that?
I was disappointed that I'm going to be like I'm in therapy right now and I'm trying to express my feelings. I was disappointed that Jadon Sancho did not start over Alejandro Garnacho. I was intrigued by running it back with this midfield. A midfield which Casemiro clearly needs some help. Yeah. I mean, I think Mason Mount was further ahead of Bruno Fernandes, which is probably why Bruno Fernandes's dribbled pass number is, you know, 7.
But defensively, Mount was more like next to Casemiro. Out of possession, he was more next to Casemiro.
Yeah.
At least at the start of this one.
Honestly,
than next to Bruno.
I didn't think Mason Mount, I thought he had a better performance than he did against Wolves. I just don't think he was really in a position to like influence the game.
Well, he still doesn't get on the ball. And like,
here's kind of like, well, Donny van de Beek
doesn't get on the ball, but maybe that's the role that Ten Hag wants him to play. But it's like, you can't, but does that work in the Premier League? Can you have a guy who just doesn't get on the ball?
He likes to have the ball, but it's in the same position that Garnacho and Rashford like to have the ball.
Okay. So kind of in the same way that he would throw Bruno out on the right side, you know, last year, like, would it make sense?
He did that in the second half again.
Okay. Having like Mount maybe out so that way you can still have Bruno centrally.
Right, but it's like he did that again where it was like a Mount moved to the number 10 spot and Bruno went to the right wing spot, which, and was that when Sancho came on? Or at that point? No, I think that was just when Eriksen came on. It seems to be his. And he did it in the preseason too. It seems to be his go-to is move Bruno out there. I think it's more like move Bruno out there than, oh, we need to fill this position. Okay, fine. Like, we'll shuffle Bruno out there. I think it's like a deliberate, want Bruno there.
I think we got to run with Real Madrid's Jude Bellingham strategy, which is just find your playmaker in midfield, put him at the top, and then fill out the rest of the midfield with people who will do the rest of the jobs for him. The problem is we sold Fred, and he is probably one of those people who can do that.
And we spent like 4 years not doing that for Pogba. So
right, but also 55 million on Mount. Like, we spent probably 15 more million than we should have on Mount. And I think I said it. I definitely said it to my coworkers in the office. I think I said it on this podcast at the time. He's a good player. He does a lot of things out of possession. Like I was just going to say, he had 27 touches on the ball in 84 minutes. Christian Eriksen came on, had 23 touches in 25 minutes. Like, there's
not good.
Yeah. He does a lot of things out of possession. He does a lot of things that the coaches love. It just feels like he's basically that like attacking player in your academy who realizes I am not good enough to be the attacking guy. So I figure out how to do the defensive work. I work my ass off defensively and I listen to everything my coach says, and that's how I'm going to get my playing time. And he's very good at that. But like, that's like Jesse Lingard and Andreas Pereira figured that part out. But like, that's a player that you should develop in your own academy and not pay 55 million for. Like, obviously Mount is way better than the two of the guys that I just mentioned, but like Hannibal Medjugorje, like, has been in this academy for how long? Like,
give him a
shot.
Can
he not do that? Like, and it doesn't seem like he can, because Erik ten Hag does not play him at all. And the reason that managers don't play young players is because they don't trust them to do the defensive stuff. So like, Hannibal Medjugorje is not good enough in the attacking things that a manager would be like, ah, who cares about the deep? Like, Alejandro Garnacho last year was so good going forward that it was like, get him on the pitch and we'll figure out the defense later. But I need him on the pitch because he's a game changer. So if Medjugorje's not playing, it's because he's not doing the defensive stuff and he's not good enough in attack to do that. So, but like, spending 55 million on that is a lot of money when there's so many other needs in the team.
Well, and for the Medjugorje point too, again, United had two goalkeepers on the bench. So it's like,
yeah.
I think they had the U21s like had a match like the day before. So like all those guys played.
They also played in a friendly on Tuesday.
We need Tyrell Malassi to come back so that way Polly can see Shaw move up the six.
To go with the question asked Colin, like, I'm fine. I was also shocked that he named an unchanged 11, but I'm kind of okay with that. To be like, I'm challenging you guys to show me it was a bad performance and respond. But they didn't. And now you need to address that next week. I think next week's a huge telling moment from Ten Hag is that certain people need to be dropped not necessarily like, and not necessarily like we're dropping you for good. It could be for a game. You have to show people like there are other players. And unfortunately in this team, there are several players that cannot be dropped because there's no alternative. You can't drop Casemiro. There's no alternative. You can't drop Rashford. There's no alternative.
To that point,
I think Antony kind of is safe there.
I don't think Ten Hag would, but
he's not starting Pulisic. He won't bring on Pulisic until the last 5 minutes of a game. He wants a left footer there. So that's basically only Antony. And if it's not going to be Antony, he's not bringing on Sancho to do that. He'd rather bring on Fernandez. So you can drop Mount for Christian Eriksen. We do know that doesn't, you know, Casemiro and Eriksen needs to be upgraded upon. There is this off chance that, especially because it's against Nottingham Forest, that Ten Hag might be like, right, I played Eriksen and McTominay several times last year and it worked, or we won the match. And he does it again, and because it's Nottingham Forest, they manage to claw away a 1-0 win, and then possibly runs them back out there for Arsenal, which will not work. So maybe he does drop Casemiro. Like, you know, he's got no problem dropping Juan Bissaka because Dolot's right there. And, you know, maybe you drop Varane for a match because you have Lindelof.
Or you're about to sell him.
Yeah. Like, you know, you said we have to drop Antony, but, you know, who you bring... Are you bringing on Christian Eriksen for that? Because it's probably going to be Bruno Fernandes out on the right. Let's say you don't bring on Bruno Fernandes at the right. Let's say you do go. You say, all right, let's put on Jadon Sancho. I don't think Eric Ten Hag would do that, but let's do that. Now you got nowhere to go with Rashford and Garnacho.
Was it Carl that was saying the Mount at right wing in big games thing?
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, I sort of just alluded
to it. But, like, who do you play next to Casemiro? Because that's where it should be Fred. That's what they did against City last year was Fred and Casemiro, and then Bruno Fernandes went on the right wing, and Eriksen was as, like, the 10. You don't have that option now. This is why they need Amrabat, and Amrabat's not coming unless players get sold, but nobody's actually... Real Sociedad was interested in Donny van de Beek, and then... pulled out of their interest. I don't know what happened, other than my friend said they probably watched the tape when United played Real Sociedad last year.
I do need to get out of here, so I need to wrap this up. But kind of going along with the, you know, worrying about the pressure on Hoyland, I'm a little worried about how much Kobbie Mainoo might be needed when he comes back from injury, because it seems like he might be the perfect remedy for this, whether he's playing alongside Casemiro or, you know, phasing Casemiro out. Paulie is nodding his head for those who are listening to the audio.
Year in a row, they've like taken the transfer budget and just spent it questionably.
Yeah.
Well, if we want to look at the Manchester United front office really cynically right now, I tell you what, if there's one way to bury the story that you guys...
They all should be gone. They all should be gone from...
Have fumbled so badly.
I would say they all should be gone for handling that situation the way that they handled it, but also because their football decisions may not be that great.
Yep.
But hey, if Casemiro is 31 years... If Casemiro's legs fall off him this year, at least that's a totally movable contract that'll be sitting on the United's bench for the next 3 years.
We just need him to hit his Nemanja Matic project lockdown or project restart
or post Mourinho fire. Like, remember, like, Matic found the fountain of youth right when Solskjaer took over.
It's like, I need a DM, and you're the only one.
which was kind of incredible, because he had been playing that season and he had been terrible, and then it wasn't even like he came back rested. It was just all of a sudden he found the fountain of youth. Yeah, like I said last week, Casemiro was garbage for a month last year, and played his way into form, and that's what you have to desperately hope is the case this year.
I will say this will be the last thing I bring up, so I know Colin's gonna go. I thought Fields had a really interesting point on Twitter. Like, yeah, this team was together for a pretty like long preseason, but they spent like half the preseason on a plane traveling across America, across the ocean. It's like you do wonder if maybe that affected some physical fitness.
They took a few flights. Like, they flew to New York, Then they flew.
At the end of the day, it's still a lot of travel.
Wrexham in San Diego.
Oh, sorry. They went to Houston. No, they all went to San Diego because that's where they were training before the Vegas match.
Right. Yeah, that part was weird. But yeah. they didn't fly the first team everywhere.
Yeah. They split up for one part of it.
It was like Ten Hag had to fly like back and forth from like Vegas and San Diego or something.
Yeah.
Still logistically, I don't know.
Everybody else does tours.
Yeah.
Everyone else does tours. They're all over the, like, Arsenal are all over the country. Real Madrid were all over the country. Why is this is the same thing as, and Colin kind of tweeted this on Saturday, kind of saying, like, why is every other manager able to implement their style right away? And we're on year two, and people are still like, well, you got to give him time. He's got to get his players. He's got to, you know, he's got to do that. And it's like, Ange has Spurs playing in a new way right away. Roberto De Zerbi came in mid-season and got that team playing the way he wanted to play. Why does everybody else get to settle in? And Erik ten Hag, after a year and change, it's still like there's still glaring holes.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will be back probably next Monday. I think that's our new regular day for the season that we're all free. So stay tuned for that. Hopefully we're talking about a win, and we'll be previewing Arsenal. So, and the Champions League draw is next week, I think, as well. So exciting. More games to not win and enter the next stage of the cycle of Manchester United.
We shouldn't be this far in the cycle. It's year two, Colin. Let's get some optimism here.
Right. Sorry.
And we'll be playing against the non-pod A teams. We should be. Should.
Right.
Knock on wood, though.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll get, Sparta something. I don't know.
Maybe we'll draw like the Europa League winner.
Yeah.
The team we couldn't beat.
Pod A. Who won the Europa League? Sevilla. Yeah, but we beat Sevilla like in the group stage. Like,
no, that was Villarreal.
That's true. Did Sevilla win the Europa League or did they lose in the final?
Sevilla won. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Whatever. Yeah. I'd rather get Sevilla as my group one team than like Bayern Munich.
Yeah. Well, until then, we'll see you next time.